KQED. Hey everyone, I'm Marisa Lagos. It is Thursday again, and that means it's time for Political Breakdown from KQED.
And me, I'm Scott Schaefer, politics editor here at The Q, and today on The Breakdown, she has been called one of the 10 most powerful people in Sacramento, and one of the most overlooked.
We're not talking about me, right?
No, you are never overlooked.
We're talking about Angie Wei. She is here with us. She is one of the top folks with the California Labor Federation.
And she has had a hand in a whole bunch of issues, ranging from winning OT pay, overtime pay for farm workers, to organizing workers at the Tesla auto plant in Fremont. All kinds of interesting, cutting-edge issues, really.
And she is very well known in the Capitol, at least, for her hard negotiating style and talent in that regard. She will join us in a minute. First, we got to talk about what happened this past week, though. Scott, you got to go down to San Diego with Katie Orr, our Sacramento reporter. You were at the State Democratic Convention in San Diego. How was it?
Yeah, well, it was cold.
Weird.
I thought I brought my bathing suit. You know, no, not really. But it was chilly. And you know, there were about 3,000 delegates. This is the last convention, of course, before the primary in June. And so I thought, to me, it seemed like there were a lot of nervous Democrats, in part because there's so many running for some of these congressional seats that they're worried that some Republicans are going to sneak through into the November election. So there was some nervousness. The big news, I guess, that came out of it, of course, was that Kevin DeLeon got a lot more votes in the endorsement contest with Dianne Feinstein. He got 54% of the vote to 37% for her. It was interesting to see the comparison between those two. It's, you know, of course, the progressives and the insiders of the party, not really her people. You know, it was really a heavily union and more progressive crowd, and they were much more with Kevin DeLeon. And yeah, you were going to say something.
Oh, I just think that watching it from afar, it like struck me how much, you know, this is the party, right? This is not the voters. And we do have
big difference.
Yeah, these top two primary systems in California that allow the top two vote getters to progress. So I think in other races, there's some interesting questions about, well, we have two Democrats in all these statewide races. I mean, for that one, I think it was definitely a feather in Kevin DeLeon's cap, but
short-lived.
I just wonder. I mean, he's, you know, has a lot of fundraising challenges. She is still so well known. Name ID is a big thing.
Well, and just yesterday, you know, she was at, you know, sitting to the left of the president in that big kind of bizarre meeting on gun control. And I thought it was sort of the best and worst of Dianne Feinstein. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the best in the sense that she was at the table. She was, you know, in the room where it happened, to quote Hamilton, but then also kind of giddy when he mentioned her name and said, hey, you know, your ideas are going to be part of the bill. You work with Pat Toomey and, you know, you'll work it out.
Right. So there's this clip of her really like laughing and seeing chummy with Trump. And I think that will definitely be appearing in a campaign ad.
Yeah. And then today it's like, oh, gun control? What gun control?
Right.
You know, Mitch McConnell. So, you know, so there was all that, you know, and then underlying it all was this whole push for single payer health care. And that has become a big issue, especially in the governor's race. And I actually want to play a couple of clips here because it's been a bone of contention, I think, between the front runner, Gavin Newsom, and Antonio Villaraigosa, the second in most polls in the governor's race. And here's a little exchange. This is first Villaraigosa at a debate in L.A., followed by Newsom at the convention this past weekend.
You got to have a plan, everybody. And anybody who's telling you that we should do it without a plan is selling you snake oil.
My opponents, they call it snake oil. I call it single payer. It's about access. It's about affordability. It's about time, Democrats.
I mean, so this is a really, I think, crucial debate for Democrats, not just in California, but it gets to the heart of some of the disagreements that are happening around how progressive to go on these issues and really how far to reach. I'm curious, Scott, I mean, you've done some reporting lately about what Newsom did as mayor in San Francisco, which he has been touting as sort of single-payer-ish. I mean, what have you found in terms of how well healthcare is working here and if that's really something he could take statewide?
Yeah, I mean, what he did here, and I have to say he was skeptical of it at first. It was Tom Amiano's idea initially, the supervisor who went on to the assembly.
Far to his left.
They were not always besties. But the idea was that this was before Obamacare, that there were people who were poor but didn't quite qualify for Medi-Cal, and so they would create this safety net for people and give them what was called a medical home with a primary care physician. And at the peak, there were about 55,000, 60,000 San Franciscans who were there. It wasn't insurance. It just meant that they had a primary care doctor and a place to get their regular health care. So Newsom says, look, I did that as mayor, as governor. I can do single payer. But they are completely different things in terms of scale, cost, numbers of people that would be affected. I mean, if you were to implement single payer, you would upend really the healthcare delivery system, the insurance industry. Employers would no longer be paying for their employees' health care. They'd be paying the government to provide health care. So it's a huge issue, certainly, and especially for the nurses, but for others as well. Bernie Sanders has embraced it, as has Kamala Harris.
Right, which is easier said than done,
very
obviously.
Much so.
And I think for a member of Congress, that's an easier thing to say because it's so unlikely it will happen nationally. Whereas for a governor, you know, there's real questions. We should say neither Newsom nor Villaraigosa nor any of the other governor candidates got that 60% threshold among delegates to get an endorsement.
Although, interestingly, Newsom did come, you know, closest. He got 39%. He had the most votes. But with Villaraigosa last with 9%, an indication of, you know, who that crowd is.
We'll be talking about that a lot more. We might want to have Angie weigh in
on
some of it.
Yeah.
But before we turn to her, I think we should talk really briefly about what's been happening in the region around immigration enforcement raids. We saw over the weekend Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf come out and basically issue a warning that she had gotten a heads up that some of these raids might occur. And now she's getting a lot of pushback. The White House said they're looking into whether she might have broken any laws there. Here's her on forum earlier this week defending her decision.
I am very confident. Everything I have done is legal. All the policies, the sanctuary policies of Oakland, California, are legal. But we are in a moment where we've got to fight back over the racist, overreaching, divisive policies of this president.
And Marisa, I should add that it isn't just ICE and the federal government that's been critical. She's gotten some flack on the left as well from Rebecca Kaplan, member of the Oakland City Council, who may herself want to run for mayor again, saying basically that Libby Schaaf needlessly injected fear and panic in the immigrant community. So, you know, she's taking that criticism in stride. And I think, you know, all in all, it's a net plus for her politically. It certainly got a lot of attention, some of it probably unwanted, but nonetheless, a lot of attention.
Yeah. And I mean, this is obviously an issue that is going to, I think, continue to be sort of this flashpoint between California and the federal government. And, you know, I did a story last week about, you know, sort of the difference between Texas, where folks or sheriffs are going on ride-alongs and helping ICE and inviting them into their jails, and here where we're trying to give legal help in our jails to people who may be undocumented. And I think Schaaf kind of hit on that. Interestingly, Newsom sent out a fundraising pitch where he praised her. So.
Right on, he said. He said right on. Yeah. That's not me talking. That's him talking. Yeah, yeah, saying she did the right thing, but she shouldn't have had to do it. But we've got this crazy administration in Washington.
So we'll keep an eye on that. We're going to take a really quick break, and we will have more on all of this with our guest, Angie Wei, in just a minute. You are listening to Political Breakdown from KQED.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, and we're talking to one of the most influential power brokers you might never have heard of. Her name is Angie Wei. She's chief of staff for the California Labor Federation.
Thanks for joining us, Angie.
Thanks very much for having me.
So we want to get your take on all of these crazy political happenings, but first, maybe you could tell us a little bit about who you are and, you know, where were you born? Tell us about your family. How'd you get into this crazy business?
Well, I think first, I'm an immigrant. I came to the United States when I was one from South Korea, except we are very Chinese. and we came in through San Francisco and ended up in Houston, Texas, where my parents ran a family-owned Chinese restaurant, working 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, and my brother and I grew up working in the restaurant. We learned the values of hard work, the value of a penny. We learned to treat everybody with respect and dignity because we were in the service industry.
You've been I'm sorry to interrupt, but you've been pretty, I think, open about saying that I think your family was undocumented. Is that right?
We were. It wasn't until I had spent years in the immigrant rights movement and had gone to college and had gone to graduate school, and I knew there was something funny about our immigration history. And it wasn't until I turned 30 years old, which wasn't long ago, I'd say, but it wasn't until I was a full 30-year-old adult that my parents finally, we were walking down from the barracks at Angel Island. We'd gone on a tour.
Oh, wow.
And my dad said to my mom, it's time to tell her. And my mom said, never, never tell her. My dad said, it's time. You know, we were once, and he kind of made a fingerprint sign and over the shoulder. I was like, what does that mean? He's like, deported.
Hmm.
Wow.
What do you mean that there was something funny about your immigration status? What were the hints that you had?
My dad came to the United States alone when I was 3 months old and went to graduate school in North Dakota. And he ended up dropping out. He says partially because it was cold, but partially because he faced a lot of racism there. They'd never seen a Chinese person before. And he came on a student visa, and then somehow he started working, and he wasn't a student anymore. So I knew, just based on immigration policy and law, that he may not have had papers, and we may not have come with permanent papers.
Do you think there was something, I mean, maybe having a hunch about that, or in the just the way your parents raised you, I mean, that pushed you to get into this work? Because, you know, you were basically fighting for the rights of people who had pretty similar stories to your own, even though you didn't know it yet.
Yeah, my parents worked hard every single day to be able to give me opportunities that they didn't have. And now this is our opportunity to give back. And it's what drives us to do this work and bring change to everybody's lives every day. And, you know, I started out as an immigrant rights advocate and lobbyist in the Capitol in 1996 when Pete Wilson was the governor and Bill Clinton signed federal welfare reform. And part of that federal welfare reform package was going to take away benefits from seniors and elderly immigrants who looked just like my grandma. And every day I'd walk the halls of the Capitol for the first 3 months as a young lobbyist. I didn't say a word. I was so nervous and scared and didn't know how to handle it. And every day I cried because nobody cared about the plight of these senior, aged, disabled immigrants who were going to lose everything. Hmm. And everybody we were working with, everybody we were mobilizing, looked just like my family. And so from the get-go, I've been connected to that experience.
You know, it's interesting because probably around that time, the mid-90s, labor at that time was not particularly pro-immigration. I mean, in fact, a lot of unions were saying some of the things that Donald Trump is saying now, which is that these immigrants are taking jobs away from us. Did you hear that, you know, as an immigrant advocate at all?
Well, I think you hit it, Scott. The labor movement has a sordid history and an anti-immigrant history from what I'd like to think is long ago. And in the year 2000, then-President Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, took the labor movement through a transformation and a change. And together, the movement recognized that immigrant workers weren't the enemy and weren't there to take our jobs, that they were actually going to be our future. And our future and our growth was going to be in immigrant workers. And it was in the year 2000, I remember I was working at a nonprofit in Oakland, and there was an opinion piece from President Sweeney in the New York Times, and I cut it out of the paper, when we used to cut things out of the paper, I guess, and I pinned it to my bulletin board, and I thought, that's the change that we've been waiting for. And the first opportunity I could to join the labor movement, I was all in.
Hmm. Do you feel, or did you feel at the time, or looking back on it, was it a change of heart, or was it sort of enlightened self-interest? Because labor unions saw this is where the growth is. This is where, you know, we have new, potential new members in these service industries, for example.
I think the one thing about the labor movement that I've come to learn and appreciate is that we reflect the realities of the time, whether they're economic realities at the collective bargaining table or societal realities that we have to deal with ourselves as a movement. I think at that time, the labor movement recognized that the country was changing, the workforce was changing, and the way that we were going to last and build to last and grow was to organize immigrant workers. And in the end, what we see is employers using immigration status as a tool of retaliation. So they would actually stymie workers' organizing attempts by threatening to call immigration. And that was something that working people would stand together and not put up with.
So now you work for the Cal Labor Federation. You guys are one of the largest sort of umbrella organizations in the state. Can you just explain a little bit about who you represent and kind of what your job is there?
We represent working people every day and work hard every day to bring the voice of working people into the debates of the Capitol. Without unions and the labor movement speaking for workers, there would be no workers' voice in public policy debates. So every day we're out defending basic core workers' rights like our lunch breaks, our overtime pay, making sure that workers are paid a fair wage for a hard day's work and not victimized by wage theft. Every day we're speaking not just for union members. We do work to defend our members and make sure they get their fair shake. But the vast majority of our work is spent defending and fighting for the rights of non-union members, both in the workplace and in our lives.
And there's, of course, you know, this week there was a big case at the Supreme Court, the Janus decision, which could have a huge impact on labor if it goes the way most think it will, which is against the unions. But what you're describing, I think, is really working with on behalf of employees who work in the private sector, right?
Private and public sector. We proudly represent public employees up and down the state.
But I mean, in terms of things like, you know, lunch breaks, I mean, you're not getting having those kinds of violations in the public sector, are you?
No, luckily, most of our public sector members are covered by a contract that takes care of those issues. So we're out in the halls of the Capitol, frankly, fighting special interests that have profit as a motive. We are the countervailing voice and force against corporate greed. And if you look at each policy committee of the legislature, we're that countervailing force to speak for everyday working people and everyday Californians. Whether it's in the banking committee, if the labor movement weren't there, the banks would have free rein. Whether it's in the insurance company, without our voice, it would be insurance company dominated. We do our day-to-day work in our labor committees and fighting for workers' rights, but we're the force that's taken on big pharmaceutical companies and finally got a bill signed last year that fights for cost containment and transparency from Big Pharma. Big Pharma has never taken a nick in the legislature, and it wasn't until the labor movement took it on collectively as a fight that we were able to pull that over the line.
So on that Supreme Court case, though, Angie, I'm just wondering, like, what you think the practical impacts could be in California, where we do have, you know, a labor movement that is so present and involved in politics. And I'm thinking really, you know, also you've talked about the Capitol, but when we talk about elections, you know, labor often is answering business money, and they're also answering whatever they disagree with manpower, right? So if this SCOTUS decision goes the way we're hearing, which is basically that, you know, this would allow people to benefit from the union, the things that unions have.
The question is whether or not public sector unions can collect what's called an agency fee from non-members to pay for things like collective bargaining. And if they may get the benefits of those contracts without having to pay in, if the ruling goes the way a lot of people think. Is that a fair way to describe it, Angie?
You got it.
And are you guys worried? I mean, what would that do, do you think, on the ground when we talk about, you know, a fight over raising taxes that unions might support or pushing back on, you know, AT&T when it comes to privacy measures, whatever the issue of the day is?
We are concerned in the labor movement. We are concerned about whether or not we'll have the ability and the bandwidth to keep taking on the fights against corporate greed. But it shouldn't just be us that are concerned. Everybody in this country should be concerned at the deep-pocketed corporate interest attacks against the labor movement. It's very clear what the agenda here is. The agenda is to decimate unions and the movement so that to take away the last barrier to unfettered corporate greed. If you look at who's funding the Janus court decision and the legal strategy behind it, it's names like the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, the Walton family. Organizations and people who have made it their life's mission and goal to get rid of unions. Not because potentially they're anti-union or ideologically against unions, but they know that the labor movement's the last defense, the last hope for working people every day.
We're talking to Angie Wei. She is the chief of staff for the California Labor Federation, a lobbyist up in Sacramento. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED. Angie, I don't have to tell you that there are a lot of criticisms of labor, and we heard some of them from some of the Supreme Court justices, in fact, especially Anthony Kennedy during those oral arguments this week. But, you know, among the criticisms are that labor unions have led to a huge pension liability that's largely unfunded in the public sector, that unions protect bad workers, that unions, teachers' unions protect bad teachers, those kinds of things. Now, I don't think you would necessarily agree with any of those criticisms, but which criticisms of the movement do you think are legitimate?
I think, you know, no movement is perfect, and I'm not going to argue that the labor movement is perfect. That there can be times in which, and this Janus decision is giving us a new opportunity to reconnect every day with our members on a one-on-one basis. And we have gotten potentially a little bit complacent in terms of talking with our members about the issues that they face at the workplace and in their lives. So with the threat of the Supreme Court decision facing us, we're going back to basics. We're going back to work sites, building committees at work site and strong structures where we can take on any fight, whether it's a contract fight or a corporate fight. We're building the structures of working people standing together at the work site to defend and fight for their rights.
Another criticism I think that we've heard, and you know, we talked about a little on the immigration issue of the 90s, but is that, you know, labor can be sort of a man's world. How have you found it being a woman in that world? And has it changed over the time you've been involved?
I mean, it has changed. I started in 2000, the year 2000, and things have changed. Things have changed in our leadership structures. Our leaders have changed. People's attitudes have changed. I feel very lucky because the whole point of having a union and a contract is to try and level the playing field for everybody so that your gender, your race, or your age doesn't matter, that you're treated fairly and people are treated by the work that they do, and their wage scales reflect that. And so the labor movement is, I believe, maybe the only force where we can actually enforce against things like sexual harassment at the workplace.
And talk about that, because we're in this moment, you know, the Me Too, Enough is Enough, or I Said Enough movement in Sacramento. 140 women initially signed that letter talking about a pervasive climate of harassment. What is your take on that as a woman who's worked up in the Capitol for so long?
We do have a societal problem. And it is getting surfaced and talked about. And I am proud of, across the country, women coming up and speaking the truth and telling their stories and finally being able to face their accusers. And I'd say that this is the work that the labor movement has done and has identified and continues to work on. I think it was last year or 2 years ago, our janitors union recognized that sexual harassment, while they work alone at night, cleaning office buildings isolated by themselves, sexual harassment and sexual assault is a real threat. And so they put together a piece of legislation that brings more training on sexual harassment and empowers janitors to do that training. The union now is doing self-defense classes for women. Our unions have been very active in trying to fight sexual harassment in the workplace. And some of this Me Too discussion, it really is taking on the most powerful in this country. But the issue faces working women every day and has for centuries.
Yeah, I just want to give a quick shout out.
Yeah.
I just want to give a quick shout out to Sasha Coca from KQED, who's done a lot of reporting about rape on the night shift and those kinds of things. I saw some signs at the convention in San Diego this past weekend about that.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to talk about the low-wage workers because we've been spending so much time talking about the politicians and other people.
Yeah, the organizing work that the women in Unite Here and the Housekeepers Union are doing. And the thing about the union is that it gives you an organization to actually make change happen at a more policy level, not just individual change, right? So the work that the janitors union is doing with the women janitors and the men janitors is changing the culture in the janitorial industry.
Awesome. So let's talk about what we're all going to be focusing on for the next few months, which is the 2018 election. I know that you guys are meeting in April, I believe, for endorsements. But one thing that we've seen in general is a really interesting, I think, pushback against Antonio Villaraigosa, who is the former LA mayor and former Speaker of the Assembly, who started out, like you, as a labor organizer and now is really angered a lot of people in that movement. Does it seem likely that you guys will endorse Newsom or somebody else?
Well, we'll see. I mean, that's the great thing about union democracy. It goes through a process. We have delegates that get appointed by their unions to make votes on behalf of their unions and their members. And we go to convention and decisions get made on the convention floor.
Do you think the criticism of Villaraigosa is fair? I mean, I think it stems, correct me if I'm wrong, from his time as mayor when he took on the teachers union, and they have not forgotten that. And, is there something more, or is that primarily what the resentment toward him is?
I think that is, you know, the teachers unions definitely have an experience with then Mayor Villaraigosa. I believe that others will remember Mayor Villaraigosa as somebody who actively brought Walmart into the city of Los Angeles and built a store in Chinatown in L.A. that now, since then, I think has been closed. So there have been some.
And just say what that memories. Means. What does that represent to labor?
For us, it means bringing the degradation of jobs right into our community in downtown, in Chinatown, L.A. It means that we're taking the low road to low-wage work instead of building a high road to family prosperity. And there are some instances like that that people, you know, folks in the labor movement have long memories. These are the things that they'll remember.
Yeah. How would you grade Governor Brown the last 7 years on how he's worked with labor and how friendly he's been to the movement?
I have to say, on my own time, I'm a fan of Jerry Brown. I've worked enough around here to see a lot of, I'll say, we call BS. And there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. And in our last administration, it was all about pomp and circumstance. So to work with an administration in which I think, number one, everybody who works for Jerry Brown seems to be very human, has a very humanistic approach. And number two, we may disagree, but we're going to disagree on policy and not on politics. And so we've been able to have open disagreements. We've been able to debate things. And in the end, we think we've been successful in having Jerry Brown see our perspective.
So would you say that there is, given that, excitement or trepidation about a new governor next year?
Change is always hard.
Yeah.
change is always hard. And so thinking it's not just about the governor, but it's a whole bureaucratic administration. And I mean that in a good way. Right. But it's going to be changed throughout the bureaucracy. And every change, you know, new regulations, new regulators could change the landscape of our state government.
Are there things that you think labor might get from a Governor Newsom that you haven't been able to get from this governor?
Hard to say, I'd say. I don't know that we're in that frame of thinking yet, but we are thinking about should the next governor serve for 8 years. We will be in the year 2027. And what does work look like in the year 2027, 2028?
That is a good question. A big question that we don't have time
right?
for, but wow.
What does work look like 8 years from now?
Yep.
And what is the role of this governor and the next administration is going to have an incredible thumbprint on that. And so are we going to be overtaken by robots? Are we going to be all in driverless cars? Are we going to be able to keep in a regulatory framework that can keep up with emerging technology? Are we going to have everybody not working and getting a universal basic income?
Yep.
Hopefully
all right.
not.
Big questions.
Thank you for coming in, Angie.
Yeah, it was great to talk with you.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That is going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. If you like what you heard or you didn't hear at all, or either way, please subscribe, rate us, review us. We're on Apple Podcasts.
And you can rate the show, but if you didn't like it, you know, well, hey, it was for free, right? So give us that. Hey, special thanks tonight to our Sacramento reporter, Katie Orr, our producer, Guy Marzorati, as always, and our engineer tonight, Rob Spate. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor, and Holly Kernan is our vice president of news.
I'm Marisa Lagos. Follow me on Twitter at @mlagos. You can grab Scott Schaefer on Twitter at @ScottSchaefer. And that's a wrap. We'll see you guys next time.
Bye-bye.